I want to thank you for two really fine members this morning. That's great. I got to say, if looking at the size of it, this keeps up. Preaching to the choir, preaching to the congregation, there's no more.
There's always room for more.
Oh, sure is. In the summer of 1955, Allen Ginsberg was a 27-year-old aspiring but still not widely published poet. He passed away 13 years ago at the age of 70. Up to that time, 1955, he had spent all of his life in the New York City area, born in Paterson, New Jersey. Now he was giving San Francisco a try. Several years prior to his moving to the West Coast, he had been treated at the New York Psychiatric Institute for various emotional difficulties he was experiencing then, and the advice he was given by those who were treating him was that he needed to suppress his homosexual leanings, divest himself of his fringy bohemian friends, get himself a girlfriend, and attempt to live a normal life in accordance with the norms of mainstream American society in the late 1940s and early 1950s. That was his therapeutic advice. And in this West Coast phase of his life, Allen decided he was really going to give that a try. He got a job writing copy for a marketing agency. He put on a coat and tie and carried a briefcase to work. He had to get himself a girlfriend. Well, it was a nice try, but it didn't work. In the spring of that year, he met a young man named Peter Orlovsky. They began what became a lifelong partnered relationship, albeit one with its numerous complications. Peter passed away, Orlovsky just passed away this past May. That was about the time that Allen decided the lifestyle he'd been attempting to cultivate up to that point was, in effect, destroying his soul. He further decided that, contrary to the opinion of those who had treated him some years earlier, the real madness or craziness was not within him, but within a larger culture that demanded he live his life in ways that were alien to him. So he lost the job, lost the girlfriend, decided to risk taking up Thoreau's call to march to the beat of one's own drummer. And in that summer of 1955, while sharing his apartment with Mr. Orlovsky, he began writing a long, epic-style poem that began with the words, "I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness," and it went from there. He dedicated the poem to a gentleman named Carl Solomon, someone whom he had met while he was at the Psychiatric Institute and who became a lifelong friend. Allen sent a copy of his then untitled work to his friend, Jack Kerouac, who wrote a letter back and said, "I read your Howl." And Ginsberg decided that was a pretty good title for this screaming poem about all that he saw and believed was driving him and his contemporaries crazy. So the full title became Howl for Carl Solomon. Some 55 years later, the poem that launched Allen Ginsberg's literary career, with the help of an obscenity trial that followed its initial publication, has found its way into many anthologies of American poetry and literature. I guess I'd say parts of it have found their way into American anthologies of poetry and literature. There are parts of it I probably would not even read from this very liberally oriented pulpit. A movie has been made about this thing and just recently released, and I'm really curious to see what that's gonna look like. Well, between the time you first read Howl publicly at a gathering of poets in the fall of 1955 and when Lawrence Sterling Getty's City Lights Press first published it, Ginsberg added a couple of sections, including a conclusion which he called Footnote to Howl. This footnote begins with the word holy being repeated 15 times with an exclamation point after each holy. Mr. Ginsberg truly had his faults, but a lack of abundance or a lack of excess was not among them. As with the larger poem itself, there are some parts of Footnote to Howl that are more, shall we say, pulpit appropriate than others, but I especially like the lines that read, "Holy the solitude of skyscrapers and pavements, holy the cafeterias filled with millions, holy the mysterious river of tears under the streets." Well, it all makes for an interesting juxtaposition. Ginsberg seeing something he calls holy right in the very midst of all that he perceived as being destructive of the soul. There's a similar kind, and there is a similar kind of destructive holy thing also going on in a lot of the writings, a lot of the songs, a lot of the poems of Woody Guthrie. Albeit in a very different kind of setting than that of Ginsberg's, and unusually with Woody Guthrie on a much more literal level than what Ginsberg is. While just barely out of his teens and living in Pampa, Texas, after moving there from his hometown of Okemah, Oklahoma, and now with a young wife and a couple of kids, Woody Guthrie witnessed the severe dust storms that blew across Oklahoma and Texas in the late 1920s and early 1930s. And they destroyed whatever meager existence those who were making their living from the land in those parts had. So long. It's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is getting my home, and I gotta be drifting along. Mr. Guthrie did not, originally anyway, intend for those to be whimsical words. Like many of his Dust Bowl ballads, they describe a terrible plight of people being forced off their land and who were moving westward, as did Woody Guthrie himself, desperately seeking other ways of making a living and trying to support their families. But in the midst of all that desperation, Woody also saw a certain kind of sacredness, a certain kind of holiness in the land that he traveled. However severely beaten down it may have been, however severely beaten down some of the people who were living on it may have been. And he wrote a song, you may remember this, about a year and a half ago, Kathy, Dan, and Harry sang it for us, called Holy Ground. Take off your shoes. This place you walk is holy ground. Every step you take is holy ground. Every step is on holy ground. I can cite other examples, but I'm going to leave it with Ginsberg and Guthrie for this morning. Examples, that is to say, of persons with artistic or poetic or literary sensitivities who seek out and at times find a certain kind of holy or sacred dimension to life, even in the midst of all that diminishes or demeans life. But one need not be in the ranks of poets and artists, although I believe there's something of the poet and something of the artist in every one of us, one still not need be in those official ranks, as it were, to see the world, to see what many of them see and sense. For the two examples I just cited point to a way of looking at the world, a lens through which we see all that we encounter. And I call this a religious lens. Religious in the sense that it gives a certain kind of depth or meaning to the lives we live and the settings in which we live them that we might not see if we didn't have that lens in front of us. Such a lens may or may not include a belief in God. It certainly does not require belief in God as a supernatural being. And I find I get, when I start thinking along these lines, I find I get some very good help from a book published by a biblical scholar and a professor of religious studies, Dr. Marcus Borg. The book is called The God We Never Knew. It's very good. I would recommend that one to you. It was my privilege several summers ago now to take a rather intensive 5-day seminar with Dr. Borg at the Pacific School of Religion. It was based largely on this book, which had just been published at that time. Since then, he has retired as professor of religion and culture at Oregon State University. The story that Marcus Borg tells in the opening chapter of this book here is quite similar to many that I hear from persons who are coming into this congregation. For he writes about how the childhood faith in which he was raised, in his case it was Upper Midwest Lutheran, straight out of Garrison Keillor's Lake Wobegon, he writes about how that childhood faith eventually went by the board for him. As he puts it, by the time I was 30, like Humpty Dumpty, my childhood faith had fallen to pieces. Unlike all the king's horses and all the king's men, however, Borg was able to reconstruct his faith, albeit in a radically altered form. What fell to pieces is what Borg calls in this book supernatural theism. supernatural theism, the belief in God, that is to say, as a supreme being who exists somehow outside the workings of the natural world and universe, and who can intervene as he, she, or it chooses in those workings. And this was the God that I also knew, heard about, prayed to, sung about when I was growing up. And while he, and this God was a he, and while he could be a punishing deity when it came to non-believers, the image I mostly got was a very positive and benign one. His eye is on the sparrow, and I know he watches me, as the very comforting words of the hymn I heard over and over played. But for all the comfort I derived from such a God at a much, much earlier, I must acknowledge, college point in my life, I am now, and I have been for some time, with Dr. Borg in saying that if the only belief in God possibility is that of supernatural theism, then I would have to declare myself an atheist. And I would guess, furthermore, that most persons who call themselves atheists are those who have rejected a supernatural God, and perhaps feeling no need to explore any other possibilities, which is fine if that's where such persons are. But what Dr. Borg is offering for those like me, and I'm sure others, who still want to keep on looking, is an alternative, in a sense, to atheism, a third way, if you will. And he calls this third way panentheism. Now, I know that's a rather convoluted word, but it still has only half as many syllables as something like Unitarian Universalism. Panentheism, as I've come to understand it, it's not so much a description of God as it's a description of those lenses to which I referred to a little earlier. It holds, as I've already been saying, that there is something sacred or holy contained within the ordinary or the everyday. And if we stay open to it, that sacredness or that holiness will, on occasion, break through. And this is the perspective towards which I have moved now in my religious and spiritual journey. I lost interest some time ago, quite frankly, in trying to come up with any kind of defensible definition I could put after the word G-O-D. What I'm more focused on now, have been for some time, and probably will be for as long as I can walk through life, is the challenge of walking through life and really seeing it. One of my basic pieces of scripture, which I know I've referred to on other occasions, is the concluding act of Thornton Wilder's Our Town, where the character of Emily Gibbs asks from her deceased state, as she looks from the cemetery down on the town in which she had lived, which is patterned after Peterborough, New Hampshire. She looks down on the town where she had once lived, and she says, "Don't people realize life while they live it?" That indeed is both the challenge and the promise of faith. Faith not in the sense of forcing yourself to believe something you just cannot accept or fathom, but rather to realize life as we live it. To believe that in this often seemingly mundane and broken world, there's an element of the holy that on occasion breaks through and blesses us, and lets us know life is worth the journey. While Dr. Borg is writing as a liberal, if not radical, Christian theologian, he invokes the Hebrew poet Rabindranath Tagore to describe what could well be called a panentheistic moment, one of those breakthroughs. This is Tagore. "I suddenly felt as if some ancient mist had been lifted from my sight, and the ultimate significance of all things laid bare, and no person or thing in the world seemed to me trivial or unpleasing." That, I feel, is what it means to realize life, or to get a glimpse of the holy. It is to see no person or thing as trivial. And from the standpoint of panentheism, through the panentheistic lenses, if you will, that is what it means to believe in God. Well, I guess this book is good and all this theory is okay, but it's time for a story. During the same week that I took that seminar from Dr. Borg, I also had an experience that has stayed with me over the years since. began just about a block or two from here, up at the Davis Funeral Home. I was asked to officiate a funeral for a young man named Trent, who had died homeless on the streets of San Francisco, to go back there again. He'd grown up here in Nashua, and his parents, though divorced, wanted to have him buried in a family plot that was out in Hollis, and so the service was held here. In talking with members of Trent's family, I heard of a very gifted and talented individual who, for whatever reasons, could not adapt himself to the usual patterns of living most of us do. His family members acknowledged his struggles with alcohol. Whether it contributed to his death or not, I was not told. He was a very capable writer. I was shown some of the articles he'd written about the homeless for some of San Francisco's more alternative style newspapers. And he wrote with passion, he wrote with anger, he wrote in a very unsentimental way. When the service was held, the funeral home was full. He was only in his early 30s. There were still many people around who had known him from when he was at Nashua High. Well, following the service, a gentleman who had driven up from Connecticut approached me. His daughter, who was at that time a recent graduate of Boston College, was working for a human service agency in San Francisco. She'd known Trent. She even arranged for a memorial service to be held at the vacant lot where he usually slept. And she had asked her father if he would come up and attend the service on her behalf. Well, when I told him I was going to be out that way a little later that summer, he gave me the contact information so that his daughter, whose name was Connie, and I could meet. And that was how I came to find myself a few weeks later in the battered-up lobby of a battered-up storefront type of building, asking for someone named Connie as people from the streets came in looking for leads on jobs or places to stay or any available assistance and the like. It was, in more ways than one, a long, long way from the lofty and rarefied heights of the Berkeley Hills, where the Pacific School of Religion sits looking over the whole Bay Area. It's a beautiful sight up there. Where I was a long, long way from that site, where I was studying with Dr. Borden. So Connie and I began our walk. San Francisco, as any of you who have been there know, it's a really beautiful city. But this was its underside. This was a place where no tourist map would direct you. We passed a line of people waiting to get into a church to be served a meal. We were stopped by someone with a story of why he needed money. In a calm, cheerful, but firm way, my walking companion told him where he needed to get the help he needed. She was pretty firm about not handing out cash. I'm not sure how I would have felt had I been walking along this place by myself. But I did feel completely safe walking in the company of a young woman less than half my age. We met a few people who had known Trent. She introduced me to them, told them I conducted a funeral for him back east in a town called Nashua, New Hampshire. I don't think any of them had ever heard of such a place, but they did thank me. We came to a small vacant lot. Back from the street a ways, a couple of buildings met at a right angle, and there was this really forlorn-looking little tree sitting back in that corner. There was a pile of withered flowers still scattered around the trunk, placed there by friends from the memorial service that had been held a few weeks earlier. Connie asked if I would stand next to the tree and if I'd say a little prayer for Trent. I obliged. Then we walked back to where she worked. We said our goodbyes. I drove back over the Bay Bridge, back up to the Berkeley Hills. Our time together had lasted maybe half an hour, and that was our only contact. The last thing I want to do here is romanticize or sentimentalize homelessness or poverty, as there's none that he had in such settings. Neither will I attempt here and now to affix blame or come up with reasons why such conditions exist. For there really is no one explanation. There's no one single culprit as to why some persons struggle for existence in the midst of a relative comfort most of us know. That's a tough and a complex issue, not one to be easily untangled. But what I saw on that short little journey was about more than struggles for material survival. It was that, to be sure. But it was more than that. There was also a need and a desire by my companion and guide for a brief time, a as well as those we met up with, to affirm a life that had touched other lives, a life that had its own kind of sacredness and holiness to it, however broken, however beaten it might have also been. The withered flowers and the hard dirt at that site were evocative of those lines of Ginsberg's I cited earlier, holy the mysterious river of tears under the streets, as well as those of Woody Guthrie, every step you take is holy ground. As I said earlier, I'm not putting forth a belief system with all this, so much as I am offering a lens through which we can look at the world around us. It is a lens that opens us up to its beauty as well as to its brokenness. It is the lens through which Albert Schweitzer looked when he proclaimed and lived out what he called a reverence for life. For seeking and at times finding an essential holiness or sacredness to life also can provide us with a call to awareness and a call to response whenever that holiness is violated. When children suffer from want, or hunger, or disease, or are innocently caught in the ravages of war, the sacred, the holy, is violated. When the earth is despoiled by human greed and overreaching, the sacred is violated. When a person's essential human dignity is demeaned because of their race or gender or ethnicity or faith stance or sexual orientation or station in life, sacred is violated. When we see the holy profaned or when we violate it ourselves, we are then called to renewal and recommit to be persons of faith in the best sense of the word. The faith that we can be agents of healing and reconciliation and transformation in the broken places of life. So I've offered two personal experiences today, in hope that they are more than personal to me, that they might recall for you some of your own sense of the mystery that connects us. You pick up a phrase from last Sunday's sermon and a phrase we invoke every Sunday here. One of those experiences took place in the literal lofty heights of academia, the other, named quite literally, on some down and dirty streets. The common message in the two settings is that contained within the ordinariness of life, and sometimes contained even within the meaner and crueler aspects of life, is the truth that none of it, to recall Tagore again, is really trivial. There is a presence, a power, a spirit, add to that all the other words that Anya offered in her reading earlier. There is a presence within that ordinariness, even within that meanness, that can bless us and summon us to keep faith with both the life we live and the life to which we aspire. And finally, to let go then of the God of supernatural theism is not, as I see it, to let go of or give up on catching glimpses of the divine or finding the holy that runs even beneath a river of tears. A holiness that flows through this infinitely natural world and universe in which we all live and move and have our beings. For this natural world is our home, the only home we have. It is the home in which we continue on our quest and on our calling to believe in life. So on that note, let's sing our closing hymn, We Laugh, We Cry.